And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's largest nurses union speaks out, saying that there's a staffing crisis at local hospitals. Courts are ruling that nurses, teachers, paramedics, and firefighters have to get vaccinated or risk losing their jobs. And relief's on the way for Oregonians who owe tens of thousands of dollars for their education. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 7th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our Fall Fun Drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Oregonians who want to keep their jobs will have to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in more cases. The courts are ruling in favor of requiring vaccinations for those working in healthcare and emergency settings. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade has the latest on the story.
The Oregon Court of Appeals ruled on Tuesday that it would not intervene to stop a state mandate requiring certain essential workers to become fully vaccinated against COVID-19 by October 18th. The blow came to 25 healthcare workers, paramedics, and firefighters who had petitioned the court to overturn the authority of Governor Kate Brown and the Oregon Health Authority from enforcing the mandate. Brown's statewide orders were announced late summer of 2021 and requires thousands of healthcare workers, K-12 educators, and executive branch state employees to reach full vaccination or risk losing their jobs. Those orders did provide some room for exceptions for qualifying individuals, citing medical or religious conflicts. Tuesday's ruling is the first in at least 8 lawsuits being brought before the courts seeking intervention from the vaccine requirement. Since early September, more than 70 workers who fall under the mandate have signed off as plaintiffs in the 8 lawsuits. Among their arguments, workers say the governor and state public health officials overstepped their authority and that the right to avoid vaccines under the First Amendment's Freedom of Expression Clause is under attack. After Tuesday's decision, the appeals court maintained that future plaintiff arguments seeking to halt the vaccine mandate would have, quote, little to no likelihood of success. Plaintiffs say the fight isn't over and are expected to continue their pursuit of their cases, primarily in circuit courts based on different arguments. On Wednesday, a judge presiding over a separate lawsuit filed by 33 state police officers against Brown and the OHA has become the first to hear arguments in a circuit court in Oregon. Wednesday's hearing asserts that the state could lose between 50 and 200 of its police officers because of the mandate, leaving many areas dangerously understaffed. Attorneys for the state argue that often employee pledges to get fired instead of getting vaccinated are overblown, with most eventually conceding, and maintain that unvaccinated workers pose a greater risk to the public. Medical experts say higher vaccination rates are the best tool for ending the pandemic. With 60% of all Oregonians fully vaccinated, officials say those numbers need to reach roughly 90% to fully stamp out the highly contagious Delta variant. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Oregon's largest nurses union announced there's a crisis in staffing in our area's hospitals, and they have strong ideas about what's causing it and how to fix it. Members of the Oregon Nurses Association spoke out this morning after October 4th marked the last day for most state workers, hospital employees, and teachers in Oregon and Washington to get vaccinated or possibly lose their jobs. The union announced new policies they say could better retain employees. Current reports show that about 65% of healthcare workers in Southern Oregon remain unvaccinated. And with a deadline quickly approaching, an already strained staffing sector could see a substantial impact. One of the proposed policies is asking hospitals to pause plans to return to full capacity operations. They're also urging hospitals to honor meal and rest breaks for nurses and calling on the Oregon legislature to expand the Oregon Wellness Program to include mental health services for nurses. They're also recommending that Oregon Governor Kate Brown and the Oregon Health Authority create a commission to review the state's health care staffing models. Here are the voices of some who spoke out today.
One of the most distressing things is was seeing the despair on the nurses' faces and the fatigue. And it's more profound than I've ever seen that. And having that kind of break and then getting back into the ICU and seeing what my colleagues are going through is tough. And then I had an experience with a new graduate nurse who had a patient who was declining outside of the ICU. And it was their first day off of their new graduate residency. And what I saw in that nurse's face was just real despair. And the patient was stabilized. Everything was okay. And afterward, we were debriefing the situation. And there was this despair and this look in the nurse's eyes, because that's all you can see is eyes because of all the PPE, that like, what did I do? And I think Natasha touched on that. How are we going to get folks into this nurse workforce and then keep them in if that's their situation? And that was really disheartening. And then what we see, you know, from the patient perspective of seeing, you know, almost all unvaccinated patients, and the ones who are vaccinated were very vulnerable with things like, you know, organ transplants. So they're immunosuppressed. Seeing what that does to patients, and I've had a decade of critical care experience, and to see the whole ICU filled with the same diagnosis, that never happened. In flu season, we might have five or six flu patients in the ICU, not 30 of the same diagnosis. That's like a mass casualty event. And then they stay for a long time and they are extremely critically ill. And that takes a real toll. And I think what the numbers miss when we get the report of how many infections, how many hospitalizations, and how many deaths, is we don't necessarily make that connection that 2 weeks ago when we saw hospitalizations going up and then we see the deaths, those are the people that admitted 2 weeks ago. And that's why our bed capacity started to get better after a few weeks, was because the people who were admitted died. They didn't get better.
The current nursing crisis the state of Oregon is facing has been decades in the making. As we see some small number of nurses potentially leaving the profession due to their decision to decline vaccination, we are also concerned that burnout will lead to an even larger number of nurses leaving the bedside. And in Oregon, we will not be able to educate a large enough number of nurses to replace them. Given the stress and strain registered nurses are experiencing today, it is also important to understand that many potential nurses look at the profession with suspicion. Why would a young person choose to enter nursing when the job is so difficult? Nursing education and workforce development, or what we call the nursing pipeline, is the second area where ONA is calling for bold and decisive action. The Oregon Nurses Foundation has already provided some scholarship opportunities with the focus on students in rural areas and students of color. But larger trusts and foundations in Oregon can and should be focused on providing crucial scholarships for students entering nursing school. In particular, we are calling upon the creation of new scholarships targeted specifically at students of color, bilingual students, and students from rural areas, all of which are underrepresented in Oregon's nursing workforce. Finally, ONA is calling for the Oregon legislature to investigate the creation of an Oregon Nurse Corps that would provide student loan forgiveness for nursing students who agree to complete 4 years of work in areas of the state with the most serious nursing shortages, including rural areas and community-based organizations that address needs of underserved and marginalized populations in critical access hospitals and in critical need units.
The Nurses Union says the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted decades of failures on the part of hospitals and health systems. They say new policies must be implemented if Oregon is to recover. The Oregon Employment Department reports that healthcare has consistently shown greater numbers of vacancies than any other sector since 2013, numbers exacerbated by pandemic burnout and vaccine mandates. Medical aid in dying will be more accessible in California. A new law will remove roadblocks for terminally ill patients to end their lives. As Suzanne Potter reports, advocates are celebrating after Governor Gavin Newsom signed a bill making it much easier to access.
Mentally capable, terminally ill patients with less than 6 months to live will now have much easier access to medical aid in dying, thanks to a bill just signed by Governor Gavin Newsom. Patients still have to get the approval of two doctors, but Senate Bill 380 shortens the waiting period between two oral requests for the prescription from 15 days to 48 hours. Amanda Villegas's husband, Chris, passed in 2019 from cancer soon after diagnosis without being able to take advantage of the end-of-life care option. She says his suffering and his family's was prolonged unnecessarily.
He wanted other patients to not have to endure what he endured. He told me, don't stop, show the photos, tell my story, let it be known that this needs to change.
Groups opposed to the bill cite religious and moral concerns. A study from Kaiser found that one-third of terminally ill adults who ask for medical aid in dying pass away before they complete the eligibility process. Advocates estimate that since California's End-of-Life Option Act took effect 5 years ago, almost 1,400 people have died before obtaining a prescription. The bill also requires hospitals and hospices to post their stance on medical aid in dying on their websites so patients don't waste precious time trying to find out if their provider is willing to help them. Kim Callinan with the Compassion and Choices Action Network says she hopes other states will follow the Golden State's lead.
This is a huge victory for the movement, for Californians, and for really dying Americans in every state.
The bill takes effect January 1st. 9 other states and Washington, D.C. have passed medical aid in dying legislation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
An overhaul to a loan forgiveness program aims to help graduates. The U.S. Department of Education has announced sweeping changes to its public service loan forgiveness program, which could help more than 500,000 borrowers who work in government or in nonprofits. This could impact a lot of Oregon graduates whose average student debt load is about $27,500. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story from Portland.
An overhaul of the federal public service loan forgiveness program could bring relief to more than 550,000 student loan borrowers nationwide who work in government or nonprofits. The program aims to provide student debt relief once a government or nonprofit employee has worked and made monthly payments for 10 years. But many borrowers report finding the process difficult to navigate, or like Dr. Jessica St. Paul, who works at a healthcare nonprofit, finding out once they've been working toward forgiveness that their loans or payment plans don't qualify.
After 10 years, that's when I found out, oh, you're in the wrong loan and you're not in a payment program, so you're going to have to start over from scratch. So there is no difference between me and a borrower who is starting for the very first time repaying their loan, starting at zero.
54% of Oregonians graduated with debt in 2019. The changes announced Wednesday by the U.S. Department of Education include a waiver to make all federal loan repayments qualify towards forgiveness, even ones not previously eligible. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum is among 22 AGs across the country who called on the Department of Education to take steps to fix what they called the broken forgiveness program, noting the department had rejected 96% of PSLF applications. U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona says they are ready to turn that around.
You've done so much to help our community, and it's our turn to serve you. You were made a promise, and it's now our turn to deliver on that promise.
The average amount borrowers in Oregon owe is more than $27,000. Groups advocating for student debt relief say these fixes to PSLF are long overdue, but also hope to see more measures to cut down on student loan debt for folks who may not be in the government or nonprofit sectors. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a special fall fund drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the revelations exposed in the Pandora Papers. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg has an in-depth interview with Bob Lord from the Inequality Project. Then, COVID noise filter. We're debunking myths about COVID-19. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. At 7, Hard Knock Radio. Then at 8, ear to the streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy early, then cloudy skies overnight, the low down to a chilly 39. Early clouds on Friday will decrease later in the day, will reach a high around 62. For the weekend, mainly cloudy Saturday and up to 53 with showers at night. Sunday, cloudy with rain showers, a high of 56. Today in history, on this date in 2001, a U.S.-led coalition began attacks on Taliban-controlled Afghanistan with an intense bombing campaign. The conflict with Afghanistan would span 2 decades, becoming the longest war in U.S. history. Our quote of the day is from Abraham Lincoln, who said, "There is no honorable way to kill, no gentle way to destroy. There is nothing good in war except its ending." Senate Democrats reach a deal with Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell on a debt ceiling vote. A federal student loan forgiveness program relaxes its rules. And Republicans call on President Biden to address the southern border crisis. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We don't need to kick the can. We don't need to go through a cumbersome process that every day brings additional risks.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki called on Senate Republicans to end uncertainty over raising the debt limit. Democrats now say they are willing to accept an offer from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell for a short-term hike. The deal would allow Democrats to use normal procedures to pass an emergency debt limit extension to cover current spending levels until December. The Department of Education announced Wednesday it's temporarily relaxing rules governing a student loan forgiveness program in order to make it easier for service members, teachers, nurses, and other public servants to qualify for debt relief. It's estimated thousands of borrowers will automatically be eligible for student loan forgiveness. The Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing Wednesday on the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Kristen Clark, head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, urged Congress to move quickly to strengthen the law.
The John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act contains a number of provisions that help ensure that the bill is truly focused and tailored on the current problems and current conditions in the country when it comes to voting discrimination.
Clark's testimony comes one day after Senate Democrats introduced legislation aimed at restoring voting protections lost in 2 Supreme Court decisions over the last decade. Andrew Yang announced he has left the Democratic Party and is now a registered independent.
I left because of the polarization that unfortunately threatens to tear our country apart.
He also announced the launch of his Forward Party. In a letter on the new party's website, Yang points to data suggesting Americans favor a third political party. House and Senate Republicans are demanding transparency and action from the Biden administration on what they deem to be an out-of-control situation at the southern border. Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
This year, because Joe Biden and Kamala Harris refused to enforce the law, have continued to be utterly lawless, we are seeing the highest rate of illegal immigration in 21 years.
A group of Republican lawmakers on the House Homeland Security Committee wrote a letter to President Biden and the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, accusing the administration of failing to acknowledge the situation as a, quote, national security and humanitarian crisis. Finally, the Biden administration said the White House is allocating an additional $1 billion for millions of rapid COVID-19 at-home tests. Shortages of test kits are being reported around the country. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Trudeau apologizes for vacationing on Truth and Reconciliation Day. And a national campaign launches to elevate the voices of tribal college students. With these stories and more, here's National Native News, the daily report dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has apologized for taking a vacation on Canada's first ever day for truth and reconciliation, Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The new federal holiday was on September the 30th. It was a day that tens of thousands of people across Canada took time to reflect on Canada's treatment of Indigenous people. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau attended an event in Ottawa to mark the occasion the night before. But on the actual day, he traveled to Canada's west coast to spend time with his family. He had been widely criticized by politicians and Native leaders last week for that decision. On Wednesday, Trudeau, during a news conference in Ottawa, admitted that traveling on the day for truth and reconciliation was a mistake, and he regrets it.
The first National Day of Truth and Reconciliation was a time for Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people alike to reflect and connect, think about the past, but also focus on the future.
Trudeau also said he apologized to Chief Casimir of the Tecumlups-Tisewepmek First Nation in British Columbia for not being with her and her community, even though he had been invited. Some Native leaders called Trudeau's trip a disappointment. Trudeau said his government will continue to do even more on the path of reconciliation, whether it's continuing to eliminate long-term boil water advisories or better investments in housing and support for children across the country. The Canadian Parliament passed a law in June to recognize a National Day for Truth and Reconciliation each September 30th. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says bipartisan work seeks to bring more awareness and support for historical trauma and impacts on American Indian and Alaska Native people. Murkowski spoke on the Senate floor last week about Indian boarding schools and introduced a resolution supporting a day of remembrance.
We're hoping to be able to work together and bring more awareness to those we lost and support for those who still suffer from the trauma that they and their loved ones experienced in Indian boarding schools.
A House version was also introduced. Murkowski spoke Wednesday at the National Indian Health Board's virtual conference. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Monday, October 11th is Indigenous Peoples Day. A national organization will host an online concert Sunday night as part of its effort to call attention to the contributions of Native Americans and the need to recognize tribal college students. As Mike Moen reports, it's an effort to help tribal college students feel seen.
Ahead of Indigenous Peoples Day, a campaign is being launched to elevate the voices of tribal college students. The message centers around calls to help them feel more visible year-round. The campaign, led by the American Indian College Fund, notes that Native American students often don't feel seen in higher education settings. As they map out their futures, some say it's time for their peers and society in general to be more inclusive and recognize the contributions and ambitions of these students. In northeastern Wisconsin, Jasmine Niosh, who attends the College of Menominee Nation, says she's encountered these issues in her academic career at prior mainstream institutions.
It's oftentimes surprising for people to see us as culturally well-read, you know, contemporary people.
Niosh says universities have improved in this area, but she adds that as a tribal student, she still feels the need to pursue more avenues in higher education to feel accepted. Coinciding with the campaign is an online concert this Sunday evening hosted by the College Fund. It will include stories from students and music from several well-known artists. It begins at 7:30 Central Time. Jacob MacArthur of the White Earth Ojibwe Nation is pursuing a master's degree in neighboring Minnesota. He says even though he's had success in his college career, there is a question still looming.
Will I be looked at like legitimate, like my degree is as good as everybody else's? That's a very real concern.
Both students also feel that mainstream colleges and universities need to incorporate more Native history and culture in their teachings. Niosh says a more welcoming and responsive environment would especially be helpful to younger tribal students going to college for the first time.
When you're a kid, it's overwhelming and exhausting, and you get kind of tired of not being around people who look like you.
Indigenous students represent only 1% of the U.S. undergraduate population. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 7th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Althea Billings, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Moen. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Native Voice One and Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. KBOO is in our fall fund drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you would like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Bob Ward from the Inequality Project on the Pandora Papers with KBOO's Jenka Soderberg.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined on the line today by Lord, a Phoenix tax attorney and associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He is also a legal expert on trusts, estate tax law, and the complicated tax dodges deployed by the super wealthy. Thank you for joining us today, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
And we are talking about the Pandora Papers, which were released earlier this week, nearly 12 million documents revealing the hidden wealth, secret dealings of hundreds of the world's wealthiest people. And can you just start by telling us what are these Pandora Papers and what are some of the key things that they've revealed?
The Pandora Papers are basically just documents that show how much wealth is stashed in these so-called tax and secrecy havens. And fascinating who's included. We have a lot of world leaders. I mean, we suspected all along that, you know, the billionaires would be in that group. But, you know, you have, you know, Tony Blair and others who, you know, really have spent their lives supposedly in public service, yet they're showing up with relatively large large amounts stashed away in these secrecy havens. But really, I think the biggest takeaway is something that the folks who have worked in this area have known for a while, that the United States has become a tax haven for the very, very wealthy, and jurisdictions, states within the United States, have become secrecy havens, with the leader by far being South Dakota. And it's a problem when something needs to be done about it.
Well, and let's talk about South Dakota. I mean, it is now being revealed as one of the world's biggest tax havens for the wealthy elite. How did this come to be, and how long has it been the case?
Well, you know, there's a pattern that is, you know, it's absolutely obvious when you look at where these havens are located, both internationally and domestically within the United States. And what you see, and it makes sense, the low population jurisdictions are the ones that seize on this as an opportunity. Internationally, you have places like Bermuda, the Cayman Islands, Luxembourg, all with relatively low populations. And in the United States, same thing, South Dakota, Delaware, Wyoming, Alaska. And so what's going on? Well, it's a cost-benefit thing. If these places like South Dakota gut the laws that protect the citizenry at large in order to benefit, say, the trust industry, as has been done in South Dakota, they get all the benefits in terms of, you know, revenue flowing into the state, but the negatives are shared with the entire country. And because South Dakota has a low population, most of that cost is borne more by folks in California and Texas and New York than by the citizens of South Dakota. So if you put ethics aside, it's not a brainer for leaders in South Dakota to welcome the trust industry there and enact all sorts of laws to facilitate what they're trying to do, which is basically, you know, protect the wealth of the very, very wealthy, not only from taxation, but from legitimate legal claims by creditors, by ex-spouses, by foreign governments. And that's what we have here. And you know, if you follow the actions of South Dakota's representatives in Congress, John Thune, Mike Rounds, and until 2017, Kristi Noem, they're out there leading the charge to say gut the federal, actually repeal the federal estate tax, and to oppose income tax measures that would reach some of the wealth that's held in these South Dakota trusts. And the number's enormous. It was $367 billion as of a year ago, and my understanding is it's closer to half a trillion now that's held in South Dakota in trust.
So the old adage that that the wealthy have pulled themselves up by the bootstraps is very much countered by the fact that this generational wealth is being not just hoarded, but put into these kind of secretive loopholes to be able to continue through generations. Now, there have been these attempts to overthrow the estate tax, one of which was countered by South Dakota Republican John Thune as saying, well, this is a death tax and we can't let that happen. And I wonder, and he later went back on that and said, well, we can't allow just an increase of the exemption level in order to give some sort of political leverage, but these taxes aren't affecting most people. I mean, who is actually benefiting from these loopholes that are being exposed?
Well, you know, what Thune and his and his fellow, you know, fellow travelers do is they basically try to hide behind farmers. They claim that these loopholes are there to protect farmers, and it's absolute nonsense. And it comes out when protections for farmers are offered up and there's no interest. I actually had personal experience where there was a farmer from New York who had what I thought was a legitimate complaint that the protections that extend when a farm is passed down to family members don't apply if the farm is passed to loyal employees, where the children of the farmer aren't really interested in continuing to run the farm. And I was sympathetic to that, and I wanted to work with him to extend the protection. I couldn't get a reply to an email because that wasn't the purpose of the complaint. The complaint was there because it was just to raise a fuss to protect the billionaires. It's really not closing these loopholes will not hurt the farmers. The farmers will be protected. And that's why you hear a lot from the South Dakota politicians about all these farmers in their state. And it's kind of convenient that they have a state that has a lot of farming activity, but it's about the billionaires from New York and California who are stashing their wealth in South Dakota trusts. It's not about the South Dakota farmers.
One thing I noticed about the Pandora Papers is there's not a lot of people from the U.S. that are being named as billionaires that are taking advantage of these trusts. Is it your opinion that this is just because of the way that the research was done and the people doing the research as opposed to the fact that Americans aren't engaging in this type of behavior?
I think so. I mean, I think that the research was done through revelations about other jurisdictions, and the information about what was held in South Dakota Trust was only through those other jurisdictions. Whereas the wealthy in the United States generally don't have enough of an upside of investing, say, through Bermuda. They can just put their wealth directly in a South Dakota trust because the United States tax laws are so friendly to the wealthy already that there's not that much of an advantage to them going into, say, a Bermuda corporation or something like that, as there would be to, say, someone who lives in Germany or France.
And this is a huge amount of wealth. I mean, we're talking about more than $3 trillion in bank assets located in South Dakota alone.
And a state, by the way, that has 800,000 residents. It's the 46th largest state. There's only three states that have fewer people.
And yet it's sheltering all of this wealth for not just billionaires in this country, but billionaires from around the world.
Right. And you know, you think about why that is. Well, if you have, say, you know, 1,000 or so highly paid folks working in the South Dakota trust industry living in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, economically, that's huge to South Dakota. Put 1,000 people like that in New York or California or Texas, and it's a meaningless impact on the economy. And that's why we see these little tiny states going and, you know, being willing to gut the laws that are there to protect not just their citizens, but the citizens of the entire country, why they're willing to take that step, because for them, it's a good deal. And that's kind of a national phenomenon where we just have, I mean, the concentration of wealth is just horrible. Look, there's this huge debate right now in Congress, whether we can afford $350 billion a year or $3.5 trillion in a decade to do important things like address climate change, like provide childcare for working families. And $3.5 trillion, you know, there's, if you take the top 100 billionaires, there's that much wealth right there. And so we can't afford that for a country of 330 million people, but we can have 100 billionaires control that much wealth. It makes no sense. That's what happens when things get this unequal.
And you work with the Institute for Policy Studies. Are there policy recommendations or things that you think people can do to take action in response to these revelations?
Oh, absolutely. The loopholes in the tax law could be closed. We could easily raise the rate of tax on large estates. There's a loophole called the stepped up basis, where what happens is when someone with huge gains, say in a stock that they own, and the stock's not been sold, when they die, all those gains just get wiped out. So, like, for example, Jeff Bezos, whose wealth almost is entirely in his Amazon stock that he paid virtually nothing for because he was the guy who founded the company, right? So, you know, over $100 billion of gains. If Jeff Bezos died tomorrow, those $100 billion of gains would just go untaxed. The tax would be wiped out. And, you know, the legislation to address that is pretty straightforward. But there's some very, very powerful interests that stand in the way.
Is there legislation that's been introduced right now that people could be calling their representatives about?
Yes. There's legislation to reform the estate tax. There's a proposal called the billionaire's tax that would address this problem of gains going untaxed. There's legislation to increase the rate of tax on capital gains. There's legislation to address something called carried interest, where hedge fund managers get a better rate of tax than everyone else pays on the amount they're paid for their work. There are probably half a dozen other proposals that I'm not bringing up here, but absolutely there are proposals before Congress right now as part of the Biden plan, as part of the package to fund the Biden plan and all of the things in it, like addressing climate change, like providing childcare. There are and folks absolutely should be calling their representatives.
All right. And I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. I really want to thank you for sharing all this information. I've, again, been speaking with Bob Lord, a Phoenix tax attorney, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can find the website there at inequality.org. A lot of great info and articles there at inequality.org. Thank you so much, Bob, for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
My name is Dr. Mark Allendary, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician
That's me. And a health literacy and communications expert.
That's me. Talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
The UK's antibody surveillance program. The British government has announced its plans to begin an antibody surveillance program for adults who tested positive for COVID-19, with the rollout happening immediately. Keeping track of the virus and its transmission and effects have been a key aim for governments globally, and the UK government hopes that this program will allow them to develop a better understanding of its vaccine campaign and people's immune responses to the different variants of the virus. Aiming to find out more about how much natural protection people get after getting COVID-19, the program will allow for 8,000 participants per day, sending finger prick antibody tests for free to those who have tested positive for the virus. The program involves two tests, one to be done as soon as possible after a positive result in order to determine antibody levels before the infection. The second, within another 28 days to measure antibodies that have developed in response to the infection. The data collected will be used for a range of purposes, including helping to gauge the proportion of people who were infected with the virus despite having developed antibodies as a result of having a vaccine or having caught COVID in the past, as well as breakthrough cases. It will also help to study those who don't mount much of an immune response and whether this has any correlation to a specific demographic of people. The UK Health Security Agency will be running the program alongside the National Health Service Test and Trace System, and its chief executive, Dr. Jenny Harries, has stated that it would help the UK gain vital insight into the impact of the vaccination program and immune responses to different variants. Programs like this are hugely beneficial in order to continue to assess the impact of the pandemic and update our knowledge of how the virus affects the body and immune responses. Getting vaccinated is key to protecting ourselves, and research on this scale will tell us what kind of antibody responses vaccines provide in addition to an actual COVID infection, and help inform future public policy making on COVID-19 treatment. Oxford scientists begin plague vaccine trial. Researchers from the University of Oxford's vaccine group, some of whom were part of the team that created the Oxford-AstraZeneca COVID vaccine, have launched phase one of their trial to test a new vaccine designed to protect against the plague. Although for many it has been eliminated, and most people associate the plague with the outbreak of the Black Death in Europe in the 14th century, cases still occur in rural parts of America, Asia, and Africa. In 2017, an outbreak in Madagascar killed 171 people. 40 healthy adults aged between 18 and 55 will receive this new vaccine designed by the Oxford group to assess its side effects and determine how well it induces protective antibody and T-cell responses. Although antibiotics can be used to treat plague, a vaccine would be much more useful, as many plague outbreak locations are extremely remote, and this could become a key part of disease prevention strategy. Using a similar base to the Oxford-AstraZeneca COVID vaccine, this plague vaccine uses a weakened version of a common cold virus known as adenovirus from chimpanzees, which has been genetically altered so that it cannot cause an infection in people. The vaccine cannot cause plague as it does not contain the plague bacterium, but it does include genes that can make proteins from the plague bacterium, teaching the body how to fight off the real infection if it ever comes into contact with the disease. The director of the Oxford Vaccine Group, Professor Sir Andrew Pollard, stated, "The coronavirus pandemic has shown the importance of vaccines to defend populations from the threat caused by bacteria and viruses. Plague threatened the world in several horrific ways over the past millennia, and even today, outbreaks continue to disrupt communities. A new vaccine to prevent plague is important for them and for our health security," The Oxford Vaccine Group are already doing clinical trials using similar technology against meningitis and Zika, and hope that they can develop vaccines against new and emerging diseases such as loss of fever or the Marburg virus. Developing vaccines to protect people from these deadly illnesses will be a key consideration going forth from the pandemic. Monoclonal antibody treatments. The FDA's approval last year for the emergency use of monoclonal antibodies to help treat coronavirus has been largely overlooked amidst the mass vaccination rollout and other preventative measures. However, the White House COVID-19 response team has reported that over 500,000 people have received the treatment since November of 2020, with this number continuing to rise. So, what are monoclonal antibodies? These antibodies are lab-made proteins that mimic the body's immune response to fight off threats such as COVID-19. As the body can take time to mount its own immune response and the production of antibodies, this treatment can speed up the body's ability to fight infection while the immune system is mounting its natural response to the virus. This means that it's best to receive the treatment as soon as possible after showing symptoms and testing positive for COVID-19. The treatment can prevent severe disease if taken within 7 to 10 days of symptoms beginning, helping to reduce hospitalizations. Monoclonal antibody treatments are only available to people age 12 and over who are not severely ill, hospitalized, or on supplemental oxygen, and both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals can receive the treatment. The FDA has approved it as a preventative treatment for those who have been exposed to the virus and are at higher risk for complications. And in late July, this has also applied to high-risk environments such as nursing homes and prisons. Florida has begun rolling out mobile units to administer the treatment to COVID-19 patients as cases continue to spike in the state. However, administering the treatment faces logistical issues as its delivery can be complicated and costly for medical facilities, in addition to the general difficulties created by the pandemic in providing any kind of care. The treatment requires intravenous infusion, and that can take up to an hour to drip the medicine into the patient, or 4 injections for the Regeneron treatment can also be used. Medical personnel must stay with the patient another hour to ensure that they do not have any serious reactions, which many private healthcare professionals do not have the capacity to facilitate. In fact, Dr. Anthony Fauci has stated that monoclonal antibody treatments are much underutilized, citing that research indicates that they can reduce the risk of hospitalizations between 70 to 85%. While some health officials believe that other measures should be prioritized, such as masking vaccination to help prevent the disease in the first place, helping to treat people who face the infection is essential to beating the pandemic and saving as many lives as possible. And on a personal note, let me just say that of all the things that I have seen with respect to COVID and treating COVID, aside from dexamethasone, which is a steroid we give to people who have COVID, I'm telling you, these monoclonal antibodies work amazingly well, amazingly well. So if you've been exposed to COVID or you yourself have COVID and before you progress to getting severe COVID symptoms, go out, go to your local ER and figure out how you can get those monoclonal antibodies. And Florida is doing a great job rolling them out. They're pretty much everywhere, my understanding is, which is good because so is COVID.
My name is Hope Hickerson, one of the writers for the Noise Filter podcast. Having a baby is a wonderfully exciting time in a parent's life, until it's time to start thinking about childcare. For parents across the U.S., the process of finding and signing up for childcare has become more overwhelming than ever before, and coronavirus has only made it worse. According to USA Today, quality early learning options are in short supply across the country. Many families lack the time, know-how, and connections needed to land a seat at the programs that do exist. Then there's the time-consuming task of calling or visiting each of these providers to see if there's vacancies, filling out applications, and sometimes going through interviews. Then the months or even years-long wait lists. As a parent myself, I unfortunately am all too aware of this process. When my first child was born, I started looking for daycares, thinking I was ahead of the game. Little did I know, I should have been looking for daycare centers the minute I saw the plus sign on my pregnancy test. My son was almost one before I was able to get a spot for him. And now the pandemic has compounded the challenges. Now, not only do parents have to be extra selective to ensure their child is safe, but they also have fewer providers to choose from. Childcare centers and preschools have shut down in droves, many of them permanently. In a survey conducted when COVID-19 first hit, 2 in 5 providers said they were confident they'd have to close down for good without additional funding. According to a more recent survey, 4 in 5 childcare centers are understaffed, with staff-to-student ratios that prevent them from serving as many children as they did before. Also, wait lists in many areas have become even more widespread. Joanna Laura, a mom in Hawaii, experienced these frustrations firsthand when she attempted to find childcare once the pandemic hit. The informal home daycare her child was in pre-pandemic closed temporarily. And once it reopened, she didn't feel comfortable sending her son to a place that wasn't regulated. There was no way of ensuring the provider was sanitizing properly, and she was worried about what would happen if her toddler got sick or brought the coronavirus home. She lives with someone who has health problems, and she just couldn't take that risk. So the exhausting and daunting process of finding safe childcare started all over for her and for many other families. I have the same fears every day I send my children to daycare. Will they be safe? Is everyone keeping their mask on? Are they cleaning properly? I mean, my fears are somewhat alleviated because my children are lucky enough to be in a highly regulated center that follows CDC guidelines to prevent the spread of disease. But I'm aware enough to know that this isn't the case for many families. Cara Schuyler, the Deputy Director of Early and Elementary Education at New America in Washington, D.C., said, "We started with a lack of capacity, and now there are even fewer providers and educators able to meet the demand." As people attempt to return to work safely amidst the Delta variant surge, they have to think about what's safe for their children first. They simply will not be able to go back to work until they have a safe, reliable, and affordable child care set up. But what does this mean for families that don't have workers in the household with the ability to work remotely from home? The workforce suffers, as does individual families and children.
Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.